When Ashley Elkins disappeared in January 2025, the search for answers began immediately.
New developments in the search for Ashley Elkins. The missing mother of two is leading police to a landfill in Lenox Township.
And now, newly released surveillance and court details have filled in gaps no one expected.
How many times did the people in your family go into Mr. Booker's apartment?
I have no idea.
Revealing exactly how her suspected killer moved.
They hauled away a dumpster. They said they found substantial evidence in his apartment.
Where he went and what he tried to hide.
Did you find anything?
Yes, in the bathroom.
From a shopping cart in the dead of night. To disturbing searches he thought no one would ever see. This update changes everything you thought you knew about this case. But to understand how we got here, you'll want to start with my first deep dive on Ashley's case. This is the next chapter. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Today's episode is sponsored by Aura, a comprehensive service that protects you and your loved ones from those who wish to exploit your trust online. Ever get one of those strange text messages from USPS saying they have a package for you? Click this link to confirm. USPS never sends those types of messages. That's spam from scammers who likely got your information from a data broker or a leak on the dark web. Do you know how much of your personal information is out there? Your full name, phone number, home address, email, even details about your relatives can be sold to scammers, like the ones behind that USPS text message. That's why I turned to Aura. Aura not only monitors your information on the dark web, but it also automatically sends opt-out requests to data brokers on your behalf. It has helped me remove my information from over 18 data brokers and even alerted me that one of my email addresses was found on the dark web. With Aura, I also enjoy features like antivirus, VPN, password management, and identity theft insurance, all in one affordable package. If you sign up through my link right now at aura.com/sleuthylucy, Aura will give you a 2-week free trial. For a more direct route, click the link in the description below. Well, hello, and welcome back. I'm so glad you're here. If you haven't already, be sure to hit follow so you never miss an episode. Today's case is a continuation of our unfinished series, Stories Still in Motion, where the truth is coming into view, but the full picture isn't quite clear. In this update, we pick up right where we left off in the case of Ashley Elkins, the 30-year-old mother of two who vanished in early January 2025. New surveillance footage has come to light, footage that would shift the course of the investigation and raise even more chilling questions. Who was the woman caught on camera driving Ashley's car? What did detectives see that made them act so quickly? And why does it all feel so much more calculated than anyone expected? Let's get into it. The times you're about to hear are approximate. Multiple surveillance cameras, different clocks, one timeline stitched together by detectives to retrace the final moments they believe Ashley was alive. On January 1st, in the early morning hours, Ashley welcomed the new year in downtown Detroit, celebrating at a casino with one of her sisters. Just after midnight, they called their mom to wish her a happy new year. Later that day, Ashley spoke with her mom again, sending over a plate of her new year's meal, greens, black-eyed peas, and pork. The next morning, January 2nd, at approximately 8 a.m., cameras catch Ashley pulling up in her car and walking into a 7-Eleven. Shortly after, Another camera, with a slightly different timestamp, captures her gray Chevy Malibu pulling into the lot of Hampton Court Apartments, where her ex-boyfriend, DeAndre Booker, lives. The car had no license plate. She'd only recently purchased it. Ashley steps out of the driver's seat, coffee cup in hand, and makes her way toward DeAndre's apartment. A few seconds later, she's gone from view. At 9:06 a.m., her mother, Monica, sends a text, sharing a vivid, unsettling dream she'd had. Ashley's reply comes almost instantly. Aw, man. But Monica says, it didn't feel like Ashley. It wasn't how she normally responded. A dream like that would have usually earned a phone call, at the very least, a question. In that moment, Monica's unease sharpened into something heavier. She knew something was wrong. A few hours pass. Then around 12:33 p.m., surveillance from the same camera shows Ashley's gray Chevy Malibu parked in the lot. However, surveillance shows a man, accompanied by an unidentified woman, approaching Ashley's car. The woman gets behind the wheel while the man takes the passenger seat. At 12:35, they drive away. The man appears to be a medium-complexioned black male, dressed in a dark puffy coat trimmed with light brown fur at the hood, a black skull cap marked by a white tag in front, dark jeans ripped at the knees, and dark footwear, possibly boots. By 2:59 p.m., that same camera, same angle, shows the man again. Ashley's car is no longer in the lot. This time, he is carrying a large yellow box across the pavement, heading straight for the Hampton Court dumpster. He opens the lid, places the box inside, closes it, and walks back toward the camera. All while, Ashley's mother, Monica, unable to shake her dread, makes multiple calls to Ashley's phone. Later that day, Monica begins making trips to the complex. She rings the outside buzzer, hoping her daughter or anyone will answer. But no one ever does. By nightfall, Monica had done everything she could, calling, driving, searching, until there was nothing left but to call the police. It was around 8 p.m. when she made the report. An officer arrived about an hour later at Ashley's place on Knox Avenue in Warren. Inside, Ashley's family voiced their fears, concerns about her ex, DeAndre, and the past issues they knew too well. They didn't know his last name, only that he lived in an apartment in Roseville. The officer began working the case immediately. He tapped into the region's license plate reader system, searching for Ashley's gray 2009 Chevy Malibu. But without a plate on the back, it was like looking for a ghost. He requested phone pings from Ashley's carrier. Every single one pointed to the same area, near 11 Mile and Gratiot, Roseville, the same area where DeAndre lived. That night, the officer went to the complex three separate times. No one answered the door. Adjacent to the apartment complex sits the East Gate Shopping Plaza, close enough to be seen from Hampton Court's surveillance cameras. At 11:17 p.m., that same parking lot camera captures the man again, this time returning from the plaza where Kroger's bright signs cut through the night. He isn't carrying bags. He isn't shopping. Instead, he lingers in the shopping center's lot, pacing slowly, almost aimlessly. Then, without buying a thing, he starts back, pushing an empty shopping cart. The lens holds steady as he pushes the cart across the pavement, each wheel rattling closer to the apartments and to the camera itself, until both he and the cart disappear from the frame. Less than half an hour later, 11:46 p.m., the same Hampton Court camera catches him again. This time, he's not pushing the empty cart. He's carrying what appears to be a large pink bag, headed straight for the dumpster. Something else has changed. Earlier, his shoes were dark. Now, they're white-soled sneakers. The rest of his clothes match what he wore in daylight, but the footwear swap stands out. He reaches the dumpster, opens the lid, and drops the bag inside, before disappearing once more into the night. As the hours slip into the early morning of January 3rd, the streets grow empty. The air turns sharper, and a heavy stillness settles over the complex. At 4:01 a.m., the cameras catch him again. This time, he's holding what appears to be a large, black, shiny bag, something that looks like a full garbage sack. He heads in the direction of the Hampton Court dumpsters, but doesn't stop there. Instead, he keeps walking, straight past them. Moments later, a different camera picks him up in the parking lot of the nearby Colonial Apartments, right where their dumpsters sit in the shadows. The area around Hampton Court is tight-knit, three apartment complexes sitting almost shoulder to shoulder: Hampton Court, Colonial, and Huntington Manor. At 4:03 a.m., the same black trash bag is still in the man's hand as he moves through the dimly lit lot next to the Colonial Apartments. The camera tracks him all the way to their dumpster. He takes a moment to look inside. Then he lifts the lid and drops the bag inside. As the footage continues, we can see him retracing his path back along the same route he'd just taken minutes earlier, moving with the same deliberate pace. At 4:35 a.m., the man reappears on surveillance, this time pushing the shopping cart. It's no longer empty. Inside is something large, shrouded beneath a pale-colored sheet. Moments later, a resident's Ring camera picks him up. Its timestamp reads 4:44 a.m., confirming his route along the apartment sidewalks. The cart is in full view, but what's inside remains hidden. He is still moving with purpose. But this camera captures more than just an image. It captures the sound. The rattle of wheels clattering over each crack in the pavement cuts through the pre-dawn silence. He starts in one direction, then abruptly changes course, steering toward the East Gate Shopping Center. His path cuts through the lot where the Colonial Apartments dumpsters sit, but he doesn't stop at their dumpsters. It's as if he's searching for a dumpster farther away, one that no one would think to check. But the route he's chosen has a problem. A towering chain-link fence stretching the length of the lot, blocking any access to the shopping center and its dumpsters. There's no gate, no exit, no gap to slip through. At 4:48 a.m., the man stops, then turns the cart around, retracing his steps into the dark. From the same Colonial parking lot camera, we see him push the cart past a white car and toward an opening in the chain link fence. Beyond that fence sits the Huntington Manor dumpster, a large industrial-style bin with a white tag on its lower right corner and a light mounted above it, casting a small halo of illumination. At this distance, he's no longer a clear figure, just a moving shadow within that halo of light. The cart's large white object is still visible. It appears to drop toward the ground near the dumpster. He lingers there for nearly 5 minutes. After the drop at the Huntington Manor dumpster, the man doesn't linger. He abandons the cart and takes off on foot, heading toward the Motor City pawn shop. The shop's surveillance picks him up next, capturing him moving quickly through the frame. Hours tick by with no sign of Ashley, each one widening the gap between her disappearance and the search. By early morning, a bolo was issued for Ashley, her car, and DeAndre. It is now January 3rd, 2025. Morning gives way to afternoon, and still, no word from Ashley. Unable to reach her, and gripped by a growing sense of dread, Monica pressed on with the search herself. She returned to DeAndre's apartment twice that day, once in the morning, and again later in the afternoon, but each visit ended the same way. No answers, only more questions. By 3:22 p.m., surveillance cameras at Hampton Court capture Monica pulling into the lot. She isn't alone. Ashley's sister, Anaya, and her best friend, LaShawn, are with her. Monika buzzes the outside door, and this time a man inside the building lets them in. They walk the hallway to DeAndre's apartment and knock. The door unexpectedly swings open, and they step inside. They looked into a bedroom, walked the hallway, and glanced toward the bathroom. No sign of Ashley. Monika never told police she had entered, though she knew Ashley's phone had last pinged there, a fact visible on Alexis's phone. While inside, LaShawn noticed a phone. She picked it up, taking it with her. Later, she turned it over to police, reportedly telling them she had found it outside the apartment. On January 4th, Monika received a text from someone claiming Ashley was being held at a house on Eileen Street in Detroit. She immediately called police, then went to the address herself. Officers responded, but only looked around the outside of the house. They didn't go in. Nothing was found. In the end, it appeared to be nothing more than a false lead, a cruel red herring that pulled focus away from the real search. Then on January 7th, detectives returned to search the dumpsters seen in the surveillance footage. One clip in particular stood out, a man pushing a shopping cart with something large in it, covered in what appeared to be a white sheet, and what looked like an arm hanging out. From the Colonial parking lot camera footage, they watched as he wheeled the cart toward the Huntington Manor dumpster. At that distance, only his shadow was visible, moving back and forth. Then, the large white object appeared to drop suddenly toward the ground. Detectives said, this, along with the several minutes of movement at the dumpster, suggested he might have been struggling to get the object inside. This dumpster had a side-sliding door, and investigators noted the effort seemed consistent with the difficulty of moving a limp human body. When they opened it, the one they marked with yellow tape, they saw what their training told them was blood, a partially coagulated pool inside. That same day, investigators turned their attention to the apartment itself. They removed the drains from the kitchen sink and disposal, the bathroom sink, and the tub. Inside the tub drain, they made several unexpected discoveries: a silver earring, a clump of hair, and most surprising of all, a bullet fragment. Along with the items, water samples were sent to the lab for DNA testing. With enough evidence to secure another search warrant, officers shifted their focus to tracking down DeAndre. But by then, he was gone, having fled to Flint. Through their investigation, they tracked him to a residence on Rainbow Lane, the home of a woman identified as Brandy, described as either a girlfriend or ex-girlfriend. With a search warrant in hand, detectives methodically searched the residence. Brandy cooperated without hesitation. Inside, they discovered a dark puffer jacket with brown fur trim, its surface marked with what appeared to be dried blood, alongside dark, ripped jeans and sneakers with white soles. They matched, in striking detail, the clothing worn by the man seen in the surveillance footage. They also recovered a receipt for a pistol DeAndre had purchased. He wasn't taken into custody that day. Instead, it was the following day when detectives moved in to arrest him, seizing his phone in the process. Back at DeAndre's own apartment, they also located the gun. When detectives extracted the data from DeAndre's phone, what they uncovered left little doubt in their minds about intent. His Google search history revealed a chilling trail, each query another step toward what prosecutors would later argue was premeditated murder. On December 22nd, 2024, he typed, "Telling God I want to kill someone." Just a week later, on December 29th, his searches turned to specifics. 9mm silencer, Roseville, Michigan. That same day, another search cut straight to motive. Murder out of Rage X. The queries didn't stop there. On January 2nd, 2025, he looked up how to shoot a gun through a pillow. Not once, but twice, entering variations of the phrase. Later that evening, he sought to understand whether a phone's location could be tracked when it was turned off. And on January 5th, in what prosecutors would later point to as a post-crime concern, he typed, "What happens to trash after it's picked up?" Individually, these searches might raise eyebrows. Together, they formed a disturbing pattern, one that investigators say mapped out both the planning and the cover-up of Ashley Elkins's murder. Detectives also later theorized, through data extracted from his phone, that he may have met an Uber nearby. A digital receipt placed the ride's pickup location not far from where those final pawn shop camera frames were recorded. During his preliminary hearing, the judge offered DeAndre a seat, but he didn't respond. Instead, he stood motionless for the entire proceeding, his expression fixed in a cold, unsettling stare.
Judge, is the defendant going to remain standing? Mr. Booker, I was told earlier that you did not want to sit. You can sit if you wish, but if you don't want, you can stand. No response, so with that, any questions?
Prosecutors later asserted he was deliberately trying to intimidate witnesses. The following day, his behavior escalated. He refused to get dressed or leave his cell, shouting at officers in an uncontrolled outburst.
Mute him so that I can speak with him for a moment, please. DeAndre Booker, this is the judge. I just want to inform you that you do have a right to be present in court. You have a constitutional right to be here with your attorney. I'll ask you, are you waiting there, right? You can mute him, please. Thank you. Let the record reflect that his behavior is the same. He's screaming and yelling. He can't hear us and he can see us, so we are going to proceed with him physically and forward.
The judge ordered the hearing to continue without him, placing him in a separate room with a Zoom feed so he could still hear and see the proceedings. When given a second chance to participate, there was no change. He continued yelling over the court, refusing to let anyone else talk. What do you think about this tragic case? I have a question that still lingers. Who is the woman seen on camera with him? What was her involvement? And what did she know? Then there's the matter of a mother's intuition. Monica was right. In a Facebook Live, she recalled, "She was there, and I was there, but I was just too late to save her." It's heartbreaking to consider she may be right. Monica had gone to DeAndre's apartment multiple times on January 2nd, not going inside. From the timeline, police suspect he didn't dispose of the body until the early morning hours of January 3rd, around 5 a.m. When Monica returned later that afternoon and entered the apartment, Ashley's body was already gone. If the theory holds, they were inside just hours after her daughter's remains were taken out. This is why Monica has been so critical of law enforcement. She believes they waited far too long to escalate the case. In her mind, those lost hours were the difference between life and death. At the very least, they could have been the difference in recovering Ashley's body. And so, although the perpetrator is now behind bars and justice for Ashley is underway, until the lingering questions are answered and her body is found, this case remains unfinished. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.